Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and we are here today to talk about trade. I am joined by two of Bruegel's finest, Ignacio Garcia Becerro and Heather Graby. We are going to be going over mostly the trade deal struck with the UK at the May 19 summit between the UK Prime Minister and EU leaders. However, there is also a big elephant on the planet, which is to say the US, which is making trade headlines left and right. Ignacio, can you put the UK deal in perspective for us?
Yes, thanks a lot, Rebecca. I mean, as you have quite rightly said, the European Union is now in a very complicated trade relationship with the United States. We are facing now these threats coming from the President of the United States, threatening the 50% tariffs if he does not get what he wants in the negotiations. I think it's very important that the European Union reacts to this calmly, continues the discussion, but also prepares for retaliation in case that retaliation is needed. But more important than how you manage this relationship is that it is very clear that we need to be able to strengthen our partnership. We need to strengthen our relationship with other important trading partners. And of course, the United Kingdom is not only our closest neighbor, it is also our third largest trading partner. So I think it's really very, very good that we had positive news coming from the EU-UK summit earlier this week. I think it is very good that the two sides are seeing each other as close strategic partnership. And I think it's also very clear that the UK, although of course it tries to maintain a good relationship with the United States, on certain issues it has made a very clear choice to align closely with the European Union. And I think therefore it is very significant that in the common understanding that we're reaching the summit, the United Kingdom at this point in time has taken a very clear stance that when it comes to sanitary and phytosanitary matters, it wants to keep maintain regulatory alignment with the European Union regime. Now, we all know that the United States is not a great fan of the European Union regulatory regime on the sanitary and phytosanitary matters. But I think this is significant, and I think it's one of the signals that at this point in time, the UK and the EU would really want to find ways of strengthening their relationship on the trade side. But of course, there are many, many other aspects, but I can come to that later during the podcast.
Thank you so much for that. Heather, tell us about this deal. What was amazing to me was how quickly they reached it. It suggested they did so much preparatory work. It was not an all-night summit. They did not seem to be casting about for something to show for it. They had some deliverables and they brought them. Tell us about what they got.
Well, it was fast once the leaders met, but that's because there had been a lot of work in the run-up to the summit. And what was finally cleared was more ambitious than expected, which I think reflects the geopolitical moment, that the differences between the UK and the European Union over fish and electricity trade and sanitary and phytosanitary arrangements and all that start to look really small when the US is launching huge global trade wars, when Russian aggression in Ukraine, Europe may well have to deal with that all on its own in the future. That very big geopolitical picture looks like a lot of the problems between the UK and the EU look like quite small fry. So that, I think, is the reason why it was a more ambitious outcome. And it was also especially important that there was this security and defence partnership signed, because that opens the way to full UK participation in a European joint defence procurement project. So UK defence firms can be fully part of that. And it also makes the UK part of the overall thinking on security, the decision making, really the alliance of all of the Europeans at a moment when the transatlantic alliance is really shaky and where all Europeans, including the British, are afraid of a US withdrawal from maybe not in terms of troops at this point, but it's certainly a US withdrawal from the space in terms of European security planning and investments. as well as on a whole host of other issues, where the UK and the EU are far more aligned than either is with the US, with China, or with Russia, be that climate change, be that shoring up multilateral institutions like the United Nations. We Europeans have discovered just how much we have in common.
And this EU-UK deal was much more ambitious than the UK-US deal that came out just a little while ago. Heather, how do those compare in your eyes?
They hardly compare at all, because the US deal has in large letters at the top of it that it's not legally binding, unlike all of the EU deal, but also because the amount of UK trade with the US is much, much smaller than it is with the EU. The EU takes more than 40% of the UK's exports, and the supply chain integration of the UK with the EU and the trade in food and so on are just so much more important and so much more significant. Plus, you know, a really ambitious deal with the US would have required, you know, British consumers to eat chlorinated chicken and other stuff that is really anathema to public opinion. So that was a deal to try to appease Trump and to make things look nice, but it doesn't really contain much substance. Whereas a lot of this very detailed, nitty-gritty technical stuff that you see in the UK-EU deal on phytosanitary arrangements and energy and fish and so on, it matters a lot. It matters so much more for the economies, both of the EU and the UK.
I've read that the chicken isn't chlorinated anymore. It's bathed in an acid bath. But still, the EU and the UK are not eager to go investigating for themselves what that would mean. Ignacio, you were within the European Commission when Brexit was being hammered out. You were around for at least some of the post-Brexit tensions. Isn't it amazing that 5 years later, we're at something approaching a functional relationship?
Well, I would say it's about time, no? I think that really Brexit was a very traumatic experience for both sides. And I think that gave rise to a period on the relationship, which was extremely distant. I mean, I hope that beyond having agreed now to negotiate this agreement that would create significant new trade opportunities, it would also change a little way the way that the European Union and the UK interact. I think that the moment has come to leave Brexit to one side and to see we are very close partners. We have very similar strategic interests. And beyond what we have now committed to do in this summit in terms of negotiating the agreement that we have a very significant trade facilitating effect, I think this should really imply that we should be cooperating much more closely, responding to the global challenges that we are both facing, where it is the very turbulent trading environment, where it is climate change. I mean, after all, one of the important elements of these new agreements is that the European Union and the United Kingdom would link their emission trading schemes. As a result of that, they would not apply the border carbon measures in their bilateral trade. But I think, in my view, this should also imply that the European Union and the UK should be ready to be leaders when it comes to climate diplomacy and to be able to engage with countries in the global south to deal with the challenges linked to decarbonization. So all in all, I think this is a very important signal that the tide has changed from what we had actually been experiencing in the process of Brexit.
And do you think the UK can lead the way for the EU in diffusing these tensions with Washington?
Well, listen, no. I mean, let me just make another comment on the UK-US deal. I mean, the reality is that after this deal, the United Kingdom is still much worse treated by the United States than it was before all these studies were introduced. The UK-US deal is no more than a very, very limited partial relief on some of the tariffs for which the United Kingdom has had to pay in a manner which I don't think the European Union would be ready to pay in any kind of bilateral transactions. So I think the European Union at this point in time has a big number of issues at stake in this discussion with the United States. I think for the European Union, it's going to be critical that any kind of deal which can be reached with the United States is balanced. I mean, otherwise, there's no way that this could actually be presented towards towards a European opinion. So I believe it's going to be a very, very different experience from the one of the UK-US deal. So no, I don't really think that the UK is in any way to model about how to deal with these tensions that we are currently facing with the United States.
Yeah, and it's interesting how the UK-EU deal also anticipates avoiding future trade barriers by doing the linkage of the emissions trading systems, which means that there won't be any carbon border adjustment mechanism between the UK and the EU. So that's already moving towards frictionless trade on electricity, which will help to with balancing the energy systems and energy security for both countries. So it's going in absolutely the opposite direction from Trump trying to put up barriers to trade.
And the UK and the EU are two of the only major jurisdictions in the world that have a carbon price, or at least plans for a carbon price. Is that right, Heather?
Well, actually, quite a few countries have carbon pricing of some kind. In fact, even 17 out of the G20 members have that. But the thing is, these are functioning systems with an effective price. The EU price is considerably higher than the UK price, but it's not wildly different. And the idea is that by the end of the year, those prices should be close enough that there's no competitiveness impact. And also, both of them apply to enough sectors that they really have an impact. So, I mean, China has an emissions trading system, and quite a few other countries do. The US has at sub-federal level, so California and other states have carbon pricing, but they don't have a sophisticated a system. And of course, what the UK has, its emissions trading system, is what it inherited from when it was a member of the EU. So that's why it's so compatible with the EU system. But I think we can expect to see carbon pricing spreading. It's the most efficient, economically efficient way of reducing emissions, much better than subsidies and so on. And I think that's where the UK and the EU could really work together to show some global leadership and try and get other countries to increase their offers, especially as the deadline for the introduction of CBAM comes into view at the end of this year, to try and encourage China, but also lots of other partners to extend their system so that they can be considered equivalent enough that CBAM doesn't have to apply to very many countries. The ideal CBAM is one that doesn't really generate any revenue because everybody's doing carbon pricing and keeping that money at home.
I did not realize that 17 out of the G20 have at least taken some steps toward carbon pricing. The Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism aims to draw a line between countries and jurisdictions that do and those that don't. Ignacio, you were involved in setting that up too. How do you see it coming into play? Do you think it's going to work?
Yeah, CBAM is going to work. But I think the more important issue is that at this point in time, as Heather has mentioned, there's so many countries in the world that are introducing a carbon price, reinforcing their carbon price, and they are therefore very interested to discuss with the European Union how to ensure interoperability between the different carbon prices. A decision still needs to be taken about to what extent these carbon prices can be taken into account when it comes to the application of CBAM. That's something that Digitax will be coming to with recommendations soon. But I think, in my view, it is only a really important opportunity for carbon diplomacy. And the UK and the European Union are, at this point in time, the only two jurisdictions that have a border carbon measure. And I think, in my view, this is also an opportunity for them to discuss with all of those countries that have a carbon price, what is the better way to cooperate. It's not going to be a question of exempting those countries from CBAM, because for that to happen, they would have to have a carbon price which is comparable to the level of that of the EU. And that's, quite frankly, is not a realistic perspective in the short term. But there are different ways of actually taking into account the prices which are being applied in the exporting country, cooperating with those countries to support their progressive development of carbon prices, also looking into the particular issues they might want to raise about the administrative cost of CBAM. And that conversation, I think, is important that is actually taken forward. And in my view, it is a good opportunity also for the UK and the EU to look into their respective CBAMs, also to try to ensure that they're as compatible as possible. It would be quite absurd if a company has to comply with different requirements in order to fulfill the criteria for carbon accounting under the EU CBAM and under the UK CBAM. So the more that there is actually comparability between the two border carbon measures, the more also that it will be facilitating for trade with third countries. But, you know, we have talked a lot about this, but this is just one of the aspects of the trade agreement. It's also very important that there has now been this agreement to negotiate a common sanitary and phytosanitary area. That would imply that there would no longer be requirements to have controls at the border, that a lot of the paperwork which is involved with exporting the food, agricultural products or fisheries products could be eliminated. And I think the fact that the provisions in the common statement on this are quite detailed suggests that both parties have really done their homework. Because what is important to bear in mind is that what this common statement says is it lays certain objectives. But now this needs to be translated into the negotiation of legally binding agreements. And the Commission would have to go to the Council and ask for the mandate to negotiate those agreements. But in the fact that these parameters are quite detailed in the common understanding suggests to me that both sides are well prepared and that this does not need to be a negotiation that takes an extraordinary amount of time. I mean, it always takes time because trade negotiations are not simple. There are always a lot of details that need to be hammered out. But my sense is that both sides go to this negotiation well prepared, and these are things that could be handled in an efficient manner.
In the second half of our podcast, I'd like to talk more about what's coming up. It is kind of refreshing to be talking about the prospect for new trade deals that actually work. It seems like in the past we were talking about, will the CBAM be challenged in the international trade context at the WTO? We were talking about protectionist measures and subsidies, and now we're talking about areas for getting a deal, for creating a single area for things. Heather, you've been in Brussels for a long time. How do you see these political winds shifting, and what does this mean for the next couple of years?
The political wind has shifted a lot because of the geopolitical context changing, as mentioned earlier. In the UK, the politics around the relationship with the EU are still really difficult. And the reaction in the British tabloid press to this deal was really quite extraordinary. It was the classic arguments that we heard during the Brexit referendum. And of course, the Reform Party, which is the successor to the UK Independence Party, that campaigned very strongly for Brexit, are now doing very well in the polls, pushing the Conservatives into fourth place now, for example. So the political context on the UK side is really difficult for the British government still. And I think there was a fair amount of compassion for Prime Minister Starmer among EU officials, actually. Because they couldn't believe the headlines that emerged, given that most of the deal was really sensible stuff that benefits British firms, and it's the kind of thing that consumers and businesses have been asking for. So that's still hard. On the EU side, there are also sensitivities. From the beginning, the EU member states have taken the view that there should be no cherry picking in the single market. And effectively involving the UK fully in energy policy and also the phytosanitary rules is a form of cherry picking, because it does allow essentially the UK to be fully part of the single market in these areas. And that matches, you know, the sensitivity on the British side about dynamic alignment, which is required in order to do that, and the jurisdiction of the Court of Justice of the EU. So those were difficult areas on both sides. And the fact that they managed to achieve a deal shows, you know, a relatively high level of ambition in the circumstances. But now moving forward, it will be difficult to extend these provisions to other sectors which are very important for the UK economy, like pharmaceuticals and chemicals, because the EU side will go, wait a minute, that's more cherry picking of the single market. Meanwhile, they'll be asking for more youth mobility and things like not only school exchanges, but also university fees being the same for EU students as UK students, which the UK has great difficulty with because, you know, of the problems that the universities face, and also because of the mixing up of this, the issue of students and young people with irregular migration. They're very much mixed together in the UK debate and the approach of the Home Office, whereas it's not seen that way on the EU side. So it's not going to be easy to extend this broadly, but it has really changed the mood music, and now there are some lyrics to go with the music, and that changes the whole working culture. It means that there's a lot more formal and informal contacts between UK and EU officials, and it means that there will be these regular summits, regular ministerial meetings, and that I think could really bring back a lot more goodwill and trust into the relationship, which had really disappeared. The last negotiations around Brexit were so acrimonious, and there was such mistrust, particularly on the EU side, over issues of implementation and international law and so on, that it really is a moment now to rebuild trust that allows these you know, all of these 28 countries to work together, not only on trade, but also on these vital security and defence issues, which also require a great deal of trust. So that trust element is, I think, going to be really vital to carrying the relationship forward now.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned migration. We did a podcast just recently on talent and whether the EU would be attracting more scholars from the US based on your own Project Einstein proposal. And now we're in a situation where the EU and the UK may be able to get around some of those barriers. Ignacio, what else stood out for you? I mean, I'm not going to suggest that the mobility issue, the youth mobility issue, has been solved, but the fact that they're at least talking about it seems to me a step up from where we were when they weren't, you know, they're dropping out of Erasmus and they were breaking all these barriers left and right.
Yeah, for me, really, the highlight of the trade aspect of the summit was accepting for the first time that there can be partial integration of the UK into the European internal market. Accepting that in three areas, because there was a very clear common interest of both sides, and therefore having created the basis for a much closer trade relationship in that respect. In order to do that, it was also necessary to reach a solution that brings stability to the relationships between both sides in the fisheries sector by this extension for 12 years of the access arrangements. That also allowed to get rid of this linkage between the fisheries and energy, which quite frankly was a little bit of an absurd link. But I think in my view, the really important issue is that you have established a good basis to identify in certain sectors that it is possible to have a much closer integration of the UK in the internal market. Now, this being said, as Heather has said, there are limits about how far this model can be taken forward. We have been talking mostly about the UK and a little bit about the US, but it is maybe worth recalling that this week also the European Union and Switzerland initialed their modernization agreement, which is an agreement which is very much based also on the idea of integration into the internal market. Switzerland has integration agreements into the internal market in the area of sanitary and phytosanitary matters, in the area of electricity. That is to say, two areas which are the same ones which the United Kingdom. It also has linked its ETSs. But of course, Switzerland also has concluded an agreement on freedom of movement, which is, of course, a red line for the United Kingdom, which explains why I think the Commission and the European Union was very reluctant, although I think there was a request from the UK in that connection, was very reluctant to conclude, to negotiate with the UK an agreement on conformity assessment similar to the one that Switzerland has concluded. Because if that was going to happen with the UK, that would immediately be the question from the Swiss side. But this is unfair. Why are you pushing us to accept freedom of movement when you are not insisting on doing something similar with the United Kingdom? So I think that, in my view, has been one of the reasons why there's a limitation about how far this model can be taken to, can be taken forward. Although I think that there might be alternative ways of actually identifying the ways to facilitate trade on issues like conformity assessment without following a single market model as the one that was reflected in the agreement concluded between Switzerland and the European Union. But all of those issues, I think, in my view, are going to need to be discussed further in the future. Once the current phase of agreements have been concluded, and then there's the opportunity to look into further areas where you can actually identify ways of facilitating mutual trade.
Now, some colleagues and I have written that the UK and the EU should try to make some progress on financial services, which, like in many trade agreements, has been set on one side. Do either of you see new areas beyond those that came up on the May 19th summit where the EU and the UK could start new talks? I mean, there is a regular financial services dialogue that perhaps could be more ambitious. Are there other areas that haven't been touched yet that maybe could become open for improvement?
Well, in the policy brief, which I wrote for Bluegelt in November last year, which I think was my first contribution to Bluegelt, I suggested that beyond the issue of negotiating the legally binding agreements in certain areas, it was important that the UK and the EU identified some areas where they could actually cooperate much more closely. And I basically see two areas where I think more can be done. More can be done in terms of regulatory cooperation. I think that a number of areas in which there will be a mutual interest in the UK and the EU discussing the new regulatory developments at an earlier stage. I think also there may well be areas in which the UK may wish to confirm that it intends to maintain the regulatory alignment with the European Union, not as part of a legally binding agreement, but much more as a policy type of a statement. After all, the United Kingdom has maintained regulatory alignment on most areas relating to trading goods. And the UK now has legislation that allows them to keep this dynamic regulatory alignment through executive actions. I think that there are clearly opportunities for this to be taken forward. I mean, I also think that there should be opportunities for the UK and the EU to cooperate much more closely on industrial policies. I mean, these are issues which are regulated by the Trade and Cooperation Agreement. But at this point in time, both the UK and the European Union are going to be involved in much more active industrial policies, particularly green industrial policies. And it would make a lot of sense that both sides see how they can cooperate on this and how they can work on their complementarities. I'm not sure that at this point in time any clear idea of a new legally binding agreement comes into mind. I would say there's already four or five legally binding negotiations that need to be conducted. Probably the best thing is that both sides concentrate first on getting these agreements done, but also to changing the mood of the cooperation between both sides on areas which, as I said, do not require a legally binding agreement, but where a lot can be achieved through closer cooperation.
Yes, I think the next year is going to be about pinning down a lot of these declarations of intent that were made on Monday last week and making them into this legally binding thing, which requires work on both sides. On the EU side, there's need for a mandate from the Council on a number of things. The European Parliament has to approve it. The UK side also will need to work on it. But where I think there could be some really major progress is actually in both sides thinking about security, both military security, but also economic security, where both the UK and all of the EU countries really face the same pressures from the US, which, you know, Trump is going to ask for more alignment with the US security agenda on China, and also where, you know, supply chains on everything like from chips through to clean tech really will need some alignment because the interests of these 28 countries are really very much the same. That's going to be the area that's going to evolve most, I think, over the coming months and years, driven by the US's agenda. And that will require much more intense dialogue between national security advisors, as well as trade ministers, as well as prime ministers, heads of state and government. And so that's the area that where I would expect to see most movement.
If I could just simply add a word on that, Heather, because one of the areas where I was perhaps a little bit disappointed in the summit outcome is that there was a joint statement that was essentially about foreign policy. It said a few things about things like climate and economic security, but in a very subordinate manner to the foreign policy dialogue. And I really would have hoped that these issues, which are going to be critical, I totally agree with you, have been given a little bit more of a profile and a mandate coming from the summit. But I guess that there was a lot of time that was dedicated to find all the right language on the issues relating to mobility, the veterinary agreement, and that this strategic cooperation on economic security, this strategic cooperation on issues relating to climate, also trying to work with other countries to reform the global trading system. I think those issues are touched, but in a very, very light manner in the summit statement. And I would have ideally hoped that it would have given a much greater profile.
Any closing thoughts on how the EU and the UK can work together and also on how they can manage this tumultuous relationship across the Atlantic?
Well, just one issue, because going beyond the pure bilateral relationship, I think that this huge turbulence in the relationship with the United States, a situation vis-à-vis China, which is also quite tense, it really makes it so important to consolidate an alliance of countries that believe in the importance of rule-based trade and believe that there's a need to also work together to promote a fundamental reform of the global trading system. And that is something in which the UK and the European Union can play a very important role, but not just purely bilaterally. That's what I think this idea, which I have been advocating in a number of recent papers, of having a joint meeting between the European Union and the countries which are parties to the comprehensive and progressive Trans-Pacific Agreement, of which the UK is a member. It is something which, in my view, will be very important at this point in time to begin to create this pole of stability at a moment in which clearly the transatlantic relationship is going to be quite tense. And as I said, relationship with China are not either in a very good position.
On the big picture issues, the UK and the EU members have very much the same worldview and mindset in wanting open trade, wanting to ensure multilateral institutions continue, wanting to fight climate change rather than being in denial like Donald Trump is, and wanting to ensure a security all across the whole European continent. And the agendas have so much more in common that the narcissism of small differences starts to look like it needs to be overcome.
Thank you so much, Heather Gravy, Ignacio García Becerro, both at Bruegel. With me, I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics. You can find all of our reports and podcast archives on our website, bruegel.org. Thank you for tuning in and see you next time.